Tech lobbying groups have gone after a new bill in Illinois that would ban companies from recording people without their knowledge. Plus, 700,000 high schoolers in the U.S. experience homelessness every year. But they can only get help if their schools can identify them. How can that happen? And we hear about seasonal food all the time, but what about seasonal cheeses?
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about a bill that's meant to regulate smart speakers. And as springtime continues, we start to think about the foods we enjoy this time of year. Like it's ramp season. You might be thinking about spring fruits or vegetables. But what about seasonal cheeses? All that's coming up this hour. But first, every year across the country, 700,000 high school age students are homeless and on their own. That's according to data from Chapin Hall, a research and policy center at the University of Chicago. How many of those students are in Illinois? Well, maybe about 5,000 or so. Research shows from America's Promise Alliance that students who are living with homelessness are nearly 90% more likely to drop out of high school compared to their peers. And those who end up dropping out are more likely to face the problem of homelessness as adults. Many schools in Illinois have tools to help these kids, but not if they don't know which students need their help. Deb Dempsey knows about this firsthand. She's the homelessness liaison for schools in Kane County, Illinois. She's also with Kane County Regional Office of Education's Equal Chance Program. Also with us is Beth Horvitz. Beth is a policy analyst for Chapin Hall. Deb, Beth, welcome to the 21st. Good morning. Thank you for being here with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
And we learned about these two folks from Lee Gaines, who's been reporting on this issue for the Illinois Newsroom, and she's in our Urbana studio now. Hi, Lee. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
So, Lee, I know you've been reporting on this issue of student homelessness for the Illinois Newsroom, and recently you were last on, most recently, to talk about a little-known law that helps schools with homeless families who are, or families who are struggling with homelessness. But this is a different student population, right? Because are these students who are on their own?
Yes, these are students that don't have a parent or guardian with them while they're homeless. And so I actually ran into this story while reporting my previous one. I ended up talking to Deb, and she invited me to come to a professional development day for educators in Elgin in March. And so I went up there, and I was introduced to several homeless unaccompanied youth, or formerly homeless unaccompanied youth, that Deb had worked with.
And so one of these students was Melissa, is it Esparza?
Esparza. Yeah.
And we actually have a little bit of audio of Melissa talking to Lee about the conditions that led to her becoming homeless. And just a warning, this is difficult to hear because she's talking about the physical and verbal abuse that she suffered.
One day, my mom and I were having an argument, and it turned into the day that she ended up hitting me, pulling some of my hair out. She punched me, scratched me. I had scratches all over me. So I called my boyfriend and I told him to come pick me up. Like, I just couldn't be there anymore.
That's Melissa Esparza speaking with the Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines. Lee, how old was she when this was happening?
She was 16.
And so she's 18 now?
Yeah, she's 18 and she graduated from high school last year.
Deb, you were one of Melissa's teachers. I wonder first what it was like when you first found out about Melissa.
So you know, I was not a teacher of hers. I was the liaison for King County.
Ah, okay. Thanks for clarifying that.
No problem. And I was identified to her through the school district liaison. Every school district has to have a McKinney Vento or a homelessness liaison. I was identified, and I work very closely with the unaccompanied youth. There's a lot of work to be done with these students because we're trying to remove all the barriers that we can. So she was identified to me, and you just start right away trying to get her story and figure out what her needs are and meet those needs, because ultimately your goal is for her to graduate from high school and go beyond that.
Deb, how unique is Melissa's story of a young person facing so much abuse that they had to leave their home?
From my experience, we have more students than you would imagine in similar situations. Many, for many different reasons, leave their home. Many are because of a very high amount of dysfunction in the family, or drug abuse, alcoholism. The sexual orientation of a student may have them get kicked out of their home, or pregnancy. We have more than you would know that are out there just trying to survive on their own.
And so how many students are you working with right now, Deb?
Currently, this month, very consistently, five students. Mm-hmm. But throughout the years, as long as I've done this since for the last 15 years, I probably worked with 50 students very intensely.
That's Deb Dempsey with Kane County's Regional Office of Education. Beth Horwitz is with us as well with Chapin Hall. That's a research and policy center at the University of Chicago. Beth, I know that you do research on this student population in particular. And what did you all find in terms of the number of young people who are falling into this category of being homeless and on their own?
Yeah, so we actually looked at young people all the way from 13 all the way up to 25 in our national research initiative called Voices of Youth Count. And as part of that, we did a lot of different types of research, one of which was a national prevalence using a phone-based survey. And we found that it was 1 in 30 young people ages 13 to 17 experienced some form of homelessness in a 12-month period. Which translates up to about 700,000 of them in 12 months. We see this as a really startling number and hope that it raises everyone's awareness that this is an issue that we really need to be addressing, because it has an impact on all of us and the success of our country.
And I want to get to that impact in a minute, but I just want to ask you about what we know about that this population, or how many of these young people are in Illinois, Beth?
Yeah, so what we found is that the rates of young people experiencing homelessness are pretty consistent around the country. So we found that it's about 4% prevalence for young people 13 to 17 and a 10% prevalence. So it's that 1 in 30 number, you know, we would apply also to the numbers in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. And so as we're talking about these ages, obviously these are people, young people who are developing, who are in adolescence or young adulthood. I wonder why you think it's especially important to intervene. I mean, I think there are obvious reasons why, but are there special reasons why it makes a bigger difference to intervene with young people at this age than maybe at the adult level?
You know, young people are our future. And so the sooner that we can intervene, the sooner they get help to be on the path to their successful adulthood, that we help them avoid the trauma that comes from experiencing homelessness and this level of instability. So prevention is critical. It's important to start intervening sooner. Otherwise, these young people are just going to become the individuals facing homelessness as adults. And that's not good for anyone if we're not able to help sooner. And this is such an important window. You referenced at the beginning the sort of very unfortunate interconnection where homeless students are more likely to not graduate. People who are not likely to graduate, or people who don't graduate, are more likely to experience homelessness. And so all of that gets layered on top of it. And so this is this very critical opportunity to change that trajectory for these young people.
Lee Gaines is with us. So she's an education reporter with the Illinois Newsroom. Lee, is there a process, or how are schools meant to identify these students? Is this something where, in Melissa's case, it seems like she kind of put up her hand and she was like, hey, I'm in this situation, I need help. Is that how most schools find out about these kids?
I can't speak for all schools around the state, but I will say that Melissa's story is definitely a best case scenario. I think it's very true that a lot of students experiencing homelessness would not self-identify the way that she did to a guidance counselor at her school. And what that did was that she was then categorized or labeled as a homeless unaccompanied youth. And because of that, she is entitled to certain supports and resources under federal law. But kids that are experiencing unaccompanied homelessness aren't going to get those supports or that resource or those resources if they're not identified by the school district. And so it's really important that they do get identified. But in my conversations with Beth, we've talked about how there's kind of this mismatch between the funding that's available for schools to do that, to prioritize and be proactive about identifying students, and, you know, the funding that they have.
How does this work in Kane County, Deb? How do you guys do this and try to identify the student population?
Well, awareness is key. And so part of my role is to provide professional development and trainings for school staffs on the McKinney-Vento law. And part of that, a big part of that, is talking about unaccompanied youth and how to identify unaccompanied youth and what it may look like if a youth is not telling you what's going on in their life. So training to create an awareness is key to this whole thing.
And Lee, that law that Deb was talking about, can you explain what that law is? It's a federal law?
Yeah, that's a federal law. And that's actually, that came up in our last conversation about homeless families. So under McKinney-Vento, both unaccompanied youth that are experiencing homelessness and youth that are experiencing homelessness with their families are entitled to transportation funding. So in Melissa's case, she told me that she received gas money from the school district to get her to and from school because she didn't have a parent or guardian to do that for her while she was homeless. She was actually living with her boyfriend's family at the time. And so that's another important distinction, that a lot of homeless unaccompanied youth are not considered homeless by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's definition, but they are considered homeless by the U.S. Department of Education, because the U.S. Department of Education includes the majority of homeless youth who are not living unsheltered on the streets. They're actually living doubled up, or they're couch surfing with friends and relatives.
And Beth, I wonder how much of that is part of the problem as well from a policy standpoint. It sounds like, I'm not sure if we have a clear definition by federal standards of what a young person who is struggling with homelessness, what that might look like. But then it also sounds like there are also some funding issues. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and this comes up a lot, the question of sort of what does homelessness mean? And so in our work, we really focused on making sure that homelessness was able to be interpreted in a lot of different ways. We asked young people what that meant to them, and that we were able to understand sort of where our data fits into this. But, you know, I think Melissa's story is a prime example of how young people fall between our systems, right? We have this young person who is able to be helped because she raises her hand, right? She says that she's homeless, so services are able to be offered to her, primarily through transportation. And you imagine sort of what her experience might have looked like so differently if either she hadn't told anyone what was going on, or if she needed a place to stay in addition to that transportation assistance. Minors in particular end up in this sort of really tricky space of who can actually help them when it comes to housing, separate and apart from the question of whether or not, you know, HUD thinks they're homeless or the Department of Ed does. Minors are really hard to house because they're not able to legally consent. And so that also layers into all of this, the experience of these students and how they navigate homelessness on their own.
And I can jump in and speak to how important, or what a difference it made that Melissa self-identified as being homeless, because I asked her in our conversation, do you think you would have graduated from high school? Now she's on track to become an early childhood educator. She's working, she's going to school. She actually just bought a condo with her boyfriend, which I thought was really amazing because she's 18 years old. And I asked her, do you think all of this would have been possible if you didn't have Deb working with you, if you didn't have the support that you were entitled to under federal law? And she said no. She didn't think that she would be where she is today if she hadn't gotten those resources and support. I actually spoke with another young man who was also homeless and unaccompanied because of mental health issues, because of immigration issues. And, you know, he told me that he wasn't comfortable self-identifying the way that Melissa was because he learned from his father that, you know, to be a man is to not speak up. It's to not ask for help. So he said he was just waiting for someone to point him out and to ask him, you know, is something going on? Are you okay?
And Deb, I imagine that is a really tough thing when we're, especially when we're talking about young people who are probably already facing some sort of trauma as well, to then also ask for help.
It's very difficult. So if they get identified to me, we sit down and I try to make them as comfortable as possible. And one of the things I talk to them about is they're not alone. I kind of give them I let them know there's a lot of kids in their situation, and that the best thing that we could do is try to put things in place to remove all those barriers they may have to high school graduation and attending secondary school or a vocation. And usually with that relationship, they become very comfortable, and we just kind of triage their needs. You know, like with Melissa, it was, I need transportation, so we provided gas cards, some clothing, so we were able to get clothing for her. And students in that situation, if they're high school seniors and we encourage them to go beyond high school, we can do their FAFSA. And because they're unaccompanied McKinney-Vento, they are allowed to do it that way, which automatically takes off the table having to have their parents' income tax returns on the FAFSA. So they're able to be deemed independent students, therefore getting some more help with financial aid to go to college or a vocational program.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about some solutions and how folks have been ways other places, and including in Australia, how that could be a potential role model for what we can adopt here in the U.S., thinking about the problem of homeless students who are on their own without their families. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll pick up this conversation just on the other side of this short break. Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. One out of 30 students in Illinois and across the country aren't just homeless, they're on their own. We've been talking about this problem with Lee Gaines, who's been reporting on this for the Illinois Newsroom. Also with Beth Horwitz, a policy analyst with Chapin Hall, a research and policy center at the University of Chicago. Beth's been researching this. And Deb Debsey, who works directly with these students in King County. She's with the King County Regional Office of Education. Lee, we were mentioning the student who we started this conversation with, Melissa Esparza, sharing her story of her struggle with homelessness and being on her own at 16. She's now, as you were saying just before the break, really a success story in terms of being able to graduate from high school. She's on her way to educating herself into a job, into a career. I know you talked to her about all of this. What did she say about how she hopes this process can change in terms of helping other young people who are like her?
Yeah, so when I met Melissa, we were at this professional development event in Elgin, and she was going to get up and tell this story in front of a room full of educators. And I asked her, you know, why were you willing to do that? And she said that it was important to her that kids in her situation get the same kind of help that she received. And so she had this advice for the teachers in the room.
And, like, if you see a change of pattern in, like, they're showing up like less, their grades are slipping, or they're just not talking as much in school anymore, that something's probably wrong and something's happening at home.
That's Melissa Esparza speaking to Lee Gaines. Deb, what do you think educators can be doing to better help these children who are these young people who are struggling with homelessness?
Well, I think they can empower themselves by getting the information, by reaching out and finding out how they can be trained on identifying these students before it's too late. Actually, as part of this conference, I just in the last few weeks had a teacher that attended the conference identify two students to me. And she said if she had not attended this conference, she wouldn't have known to do that. She wouldn't have known what to do, where to go. She wouldn't have been able to identify them. So it's important also to leave judgment at the door. Don't, you know, many times it's getting better in my world here in King County, but it used to be, you know, people would say, oh, if the kids would just follow the rules, they could go home. But they don't know what's going on at home with these kids in their lives. These kids are not willing to sleep on somebody's couch if things were leave it to Beaver at home. So I think it's important for them to leave the judgment at the door and really think about what these kids' lives are going through and talk to them and communicate with them.
Beth, I know you've been looking into an Australian program as a potential role model of something that we could adopt here in the U.S. What are they doing that we should maybe perhaps be learning from?
Sure. So as part of Chapin Hall's Voices of Youth Count, we did a systematic evidence review to better understand what the evidence base says on effective interventions that are intended to prevent youth homelessness. We looked at 4,000 studies and found in that only 62 studies that evaluated the impacts of 51 programs to include, right? So out of 4,000, culled it down to 62, which really speaks to how limited the evidence base is on what works to prevent and end youth homelessness. But among those 62, we found three that focused on prevention, and one is this Australia project. It's called the Geelong Project, which is the name of a region in Australia. And there they are using a collective impact model that's located within the schools where they do a universal screening to identify students who, in addition to experiencing homelessness now, more importantly, are looking for things that indicate they're at risk of homelessness or at risk of dropping out. So they're really beginning to look further upstream, which is what the Canadians have called their replication of this program and what we've been calling our burgeoning U.S. pilot of it, really thinking about how we can better identify students sooner, because those risk factors are, or visual cues that Melissa referenced, right, of a student not coming to school as often, behaving differently, grades slipping, those are important indicators, but may well not happen until things have been going badly for a little while.
Right, until things are too late. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Beth, thanks for joining us. That's Beth Horwitz, a policy analyst with Chapin Hall, a research and policy center at the University of Chicago. Deb Dempsey is with the Roe Equal Chance Program with King County's Regional Office of Education. And Lee Gaines has been reporting on this for the Illinois Newsroom. We'll tweet out Lee's story. But all of you, thank you for taking the time to speak with me about this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
One out of every four households in America has a smart speaker. The smart part means you can speak to an Alexa or Google Home device to get the news, the weather, music. Some people don't use them, though, for fear that someone is listening in on your conversation all the time because those devices are always on listening for you to cue them. Recently, Bloomberg News did indeed report that Amazon employs thousands of workers to listen to you talking to Alexa devices in order to improve its voice transcription efficiency. But those workers also heard private conversations. In at least two cases, maybe even assault. That story came out just as here in Illinois, state senators passed the Keep Internet Devices Safe Act. This bill would ban internet device manufacturers like Google and Amazon from collecting audio from you without your knowledge. But those representing the tech industry, and especially those big tech companies, have lobbied hard against this bill. They say the existing law already addresses personal communication recording, while others say that tech giants have stripped down this bill and made sure that it lacked protections that were in the original one. Senator Christina Castro is a sponsor of this bill. The Democrat represents Illinois' 22nd district, which includes parts of the Chicago suburbs of Elgin, Hoffman Estates, Streamwood. Senator Castro, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. It's great to be on the radio. Not actually on right now. It's great.
Thanks. So I wonder if I could just ask you, as the bill was originally written, what would it have done?
Well, so Senate Bill 1719, what we call the Keep Internet Devices Safe Act, really much deals with the microphone on any kind of internet-connected devices and also applications that access the microphone. And what it does is it requires tech companies to disclose in their terms and conditions how the microphone will be used, what kind of information is being collected, how is that information disseminated or sold, but also it also would require tech companies to get your permission to access the microphone. One example that I bring to mind was a Cleveland Cavaliers application that if you were in the stadium was automatically using your microphone without you accepting any kind of terms and conditions, without your permission using the microphone. And what it was looking for was, when you were in the stadium, it was looking for these particular sounds, whether you were near the fan shop. If you were near the fan shop and it could recognize you were on the fan shop, it would send you an advertisement or a coupon. If you were near a particular food vendor, it would pop up a food coupon. Yet the user had no idea that the microphone was constantly listening to this and was intaking all this information. You've seen Amazon recently had a story that talked about how employees, while they're trying to enhance the device, was listening into the recorded conversations, what was being picked up when the device wasn't being used, and it was being shared in chats. So the bill really pretty much helps consumers understand how the data is being collected, what it's going to be used for, and it gives them the choice. Now, we all don't read our terms and conditions, and we should. It'll make tech companies pretty much outline in their terms and conditions how all this information is being collected and used, and then let the consumer make the educated decision whether they accept those terms or whether they don't really need that technology. It's obviously up to them.
And so I know that there's been some pretty, I think, significant lobbying on behalf of the internet for lobbyists like the Internet Association. I should note to our audience, we did reach out to them to invite them to come on the program. No one was able to join us for the segment. We did get a statement that I'll read in a little bit. But Senator Castro, what were you hearing from the tech lobbyists about what they wanted to change about what you had proposed with the bill?
Well, one of the things is, I'll give them some credit was the fact that we've been in discussions. There are some instances where there's some that have not been very open-minded and are not wanting to have these discussions. A lot of the things that they feel it's too broad, but mostly some of them just don't want you to know what they're collecting. I will give you an example. Representative Turner has a bill that will allow consumers to ask the tech companies, like, what are you collecting and how? And they were going to have a subject matter hearing to show how technology collects that information, and the tech companies would have nothing to do with it. They don't want anything to do with it. They don't want to touch it. We have worked through the language to make it a little less broad, but still not to lose the goal of being able to allow consumers to opt in to understand how the technology is collecting information and how and what they're doing with it, and making sure that they disclose that. Because for the instance, going back to the microphone, they weren't disclosing they were grabbing that microphone or using it in that application. And people deserve to know. Technology is a great thing. We all use technology. I love technology. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean we should forego, you know, our privacy or personal information. So the tech company has lobbied hard against it. On my bill, I've had some conversations with many of them, and we've been fine-tuning some of the language to get
right
to the crux of what we're trying to accomplish.
Okay, and I do want to get to what you fine-tune in a minute. We're talking with Senator Christina Castro about her bill, the Illinois Keep Internet Devices Safe Act, which has passed through the Senate, is in committee in the House. Matt Erickson has we want to bring him into the conversation. He's the Industry Outreach Director for the Digital Privacy Alliance. It's a Chicago-based nonprofit focused on protecting internet privacy. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, glad to be here.
So, Matt, as we're listening to Senator Castro talk about, I mean, I think everyone agrees that technology is both good and bad. This does seem kind of, I think, a little science fiction-y with everyone thinking, oh, or it's maybe a little Orwellian to think of someone listening in to devices all the time. I want to just first ask you if you think people are conscious or aware of how much these devices perhaps infringe upon our privacy, whether that's in the terms of service or not.
I think that that's actually a very good question, and most people aren't as aware as they ought to be. We're only starting to get some basic awareness of what happens to our data in the last couple of years between election scandals, Cambridge Analytica. But really, most people have just figured that their data is not going anywhere and sitting parked on a machine.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess it's a different, I mean, even I guess the question I should probably even ask you is, what do you think should be private? Because I think even the question of what should be private is a big part of this conversation, right, Matt?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, when we're talking about microphones, for example, the default for privacy should be what happens in the privacy of our own home. That's a key principle in U.S. privacy law. If you're not, this is your own private space. What you're discussing with your family could be a bunch of things, depending on your job, depending on your lifestyle. There's a lot of sensitive information you don't think that might be getting out there just because you bought us something pretty cool where you can order a new toothbrush with a few words.
Mm-hmm. Senator Castro, what would you like when we think about Illinois law with this? What I mean, I think this does really get to the notion of privacy. And I should probably ask you this question as well. From a lawmaker standpoint, what do you think for folks in Illinois, what do you think our privacy should look like when it comes to interaction with technology?
I think one of the things you look at, you look at the FCC and just how the federal government just can't agree on a lot of different things. So it's falling onto states to look at privacy when regards to the internet and internet-connected devices. California passed a bill that dealt with the smart TV similar to the microphone. They're also looking at a bill along with New Jersey similar to mine. And so I think one of the things is, as we look forward, there's not many bills about this because this is a new issue. You're seeing more and more people accessing the information that, you know, as a consumer, you never knew could, and then you see leaks of that information. On top of the fact you have major data breaches when it comes to credit cards and other things, as you're recording or submitting any kind of personal information, that could be hacked into. And the last thing, you know, a consumer wants is all of that personal information to be out for sale or in the improper hands because it could ruin your life. So I think one of the things when you talk about privacy is, again, it's a great thing to have technology, but just to make sure that people know what is being collected, how it's being collected, where is it going to be sold, who has it. I mean, you look at groups like Facebook, and when you sign into different sites, they make it easy for you. Like, oh, use your Facebook login. What consumers aren't realizing is when you are using your Facebook login because it's so convenient versus just creating a whole new, you know, a user profile, is that Facebook has access to every characteristic on how you operate in that website or in that application. So when you go onto your Facebook page or your Facebook app, you're wondering why you're seeing ads directed on vacations because you were looking for a vacation. It's because it's collecting
right.
all
it's
that data.
Right, it's because they're collecting all of the data on it.
Correct.
Right. So, I mean, as we think about this, oh, and actually, I'm sorry, we are just about to take a break here. But it's, when we come back from the break, Senator Castro, I wonder if you could maybe answer for me just how this, how the law as it stands right now, what you've proposed, how it's changed. I know that when we talked to the Internet Association, they said this is a first in the nation law regarding internet connected microphones. And it's important, quote, that we get this legislation right. So they said they're committing to working with you, the bill author, to ensure that the definition and requirements of the bill are technically feasible. So when we come back, Matt, I want to ask you just about to respond to that as well. And let's just learn a little bit more about how the law stands right now. We'll pick up this conversation on the other side of this quick break we're going to take. But stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the fact that with one in four households now having smart speaker devices, what that looks like in terms of your privacy. These devices are generally always on, but what are they listening to? That's part of the Keep Internet Devices Safe Act that's being proposed by Senator Christina Castro. She's a Democrat representing parts of Cook County, Kane County, and on the line with us now. We've also been speaking with Matt Erickson, who's the Industry Outreach Director for the Digital Privacy Alliance. Senator Castro, so can you tell us how, as the law stands right now, what actually would happen? What recourse would people have if they feel like their privacy is being infringed upon with these devices listening in?
So right now, the enforcement mechanism is left to the Attorney General's office. So right now, the consumers, if the tech companies are not properly following procedures and rules, as was stated out in the legislation, the Attorney General can go after them. We had modified that. I think at one point we had state's attorneys, but at the local level, we just don't feel they would have had the resources to do that, and that it just didn't seem it would make sense to do that. We figured it would be in the power of the Attorney General because he does deal with a lot of consumer-based issues. And so that's one of the changes we made. The other things we're working on, too, is the cable companies had, because they're different than just your regular internet connected devices or applications, they have brought forth, and we have been trying to fine-tune some of that language in regards to, obviously, if you have a Xfinity box, there is a microphone on the remote. How would that entail?
Right, or it's the same thing, right? If you have like a Fire TV, like I was thinking about this the other day that like, I'm thinking I don't have an Alexa device in my living room, but I do because I have the TV. Matt, is the Digital Privacy Alliance happy with the law as it's written? Do you think it goes far enough?
So the Digital Privacy Alliance is where we understand the need to come to an agreement with big tech on these issues. So we're happy that they've been sitting down and making negotiations, and we're willing to work out something that I think the definition of a compromise is where everyone goes away unhappy equally.
Do you think right now they're not as unhappy as they should be? Is that what you're saying, Matt?
I think what I'm trying to say is while we would like to see some stricter enforcement ability in this law, and personally, I don't, for example, discussing cable companies, the DPA doesn't really see a major difference between an internet-connected remote versus an internet-connected speaker. They're both internet-connected microphones. But we are willing to compromise in order to get this really important piece of legislation passed, which does protect people who have internet-connected widgets with microphones in their homes.
That's Matt Erickson, who's the Industry Outreach Director with the Digital Privacy Alliance, a nonprofit based in Chicago. I want to thank Senator Christina Castro for being with us as well, a sponsor of this Keep Internet Devices Safe Act. We'll be keeping an eye on what happens with this in the House. It has passed out of the Senate. Senator Castro, Matt, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We hear a lot these days about eating local and seasonal. We also tend to think maybe that's limited to fruits and vegetables. But what about when it comes to cheese? The spring cheeses that may be best known in the U.S. are goat cheeses. And for those who make cheese this time of year, the seasonality of the milk affects the product in a big way. So joining us now to talk about the seasonality of milk and what life is like right now on her farm is Leslie Cooperman, the founder and co-owner of Prairie Fruits Farm in Urbana. Hi, Leslie. She's in studio with me here in Urbana, I should say.
Hi, Nyla.
The first customer who bought Leslie's cheeses was Pastoral Artisan Cheese, Bread, and Wine in Chicago. Greg O'Neill is the founder and co-owner of Pastoral, which has a few locations in Chicago, and he's on the line from there to lend us his cheese expertise. Hey, Greg, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So, Greg, I think people might be surprised to hear that cheese is seasonal. So what do you think of when I say a seasonal cheese?
Well, I think seasonal cheese only falls right in step with seasonal foods, seasonal wines, seasonal crops. So, I mean, when you think about it in terms of food and beverage, seasonality matters, and it has to do with, you know, what's available, the, you know, animal husbandry in a situation of wine, what's growing, what's also appropriate to go with the things that are available. So for us, you know, as a retailer, it's, you know, there is a seasonality has to do with what is available, what's the best that it's available, and what is exciting to the palate, especially when we're coming off a winter where it's been cold and we're eating lots of comfort food and heavy stuff, and then the sun comes out, hopefully, and we
not
get,
yet, but right.
I know. Well, in theory, the sun comes out and the flowers come out, and we start thinking fresher, lighter, and so I think that's the larger theme. And then cheese just is one piece of that, but an important piece of it.
So, Leslie, when we're thinking about this time of year for you, you have about 75 goats. How many? And this is the time of year where where kids are being born?
Yes. Yeah, so the thing about goats is that their natural tendency is to breed in the fall when the days get shorter. So their season actually starts for us in October when they start making new babies, and they eventually will dry themselves off once they're bred. So they're actually not producing, our goats don't produce milk year-round, and nor do we stagger the breeding. So we concentrate our breeding in about 2 to 2.5 months' time. They're pregnant for 5 months, and so our kidding season starts in March. And once they have a baby, which is something that people tend to forget about when it comes to milk production, is that goats, like cows and sheep and humans, are mammals, and they must have a baby to produce milk. We breed our goats every fall, and that way they will have a baby in the spring and start producing milk again.
And what is the quality of the milk like then? Does the quality of the milk, I guess, change with the season?
Very much so. So there are several things that influence the quality of the milk. And by quality, I mean what's in it. So milk is mostly water, but then there's fat, there's butter fat, there's protein, there's minerals. And their fat and protein is high when they have a baby. And that's so that they provide a very nutrient-rich product to feed their young. As they go into the middle part of their lactation, their butter fat and protein start to go down. In our case, we are a pasture-based dairy. Not only are we seasonal, but we're pasture-based. So their diet is changing in addition to the stage of their lactation.
And so how does when we're thinking about the diet changing, Greg, I imagine this is something that you think gets reflected in the cheese in terms of how different cheese taste.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, Greg, I was just asking about in terms of, Leslie's just talking about their diet and how that changes the quality of milk. I imagine on your end, you're thinking about how cheese tastes differently based on that diet, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the flavor profiles, as she described, you know, those things translate. So, you know, and not just in goat cheese, but in, you know, especially goat and sheep's milk cheese, but also in cow's milk as well. It's, you know, because of the seasonal aspects of what's available to eat, how well developed are the pastures that, and, you know, what's growing in the pastures, that affects, you know, that reflects the flavor profiles. It also, you know, when you take it downstream a little bit, it's what do you put with it? And then, you know, I think a lot of people love the first, you know, goat's milk cheese of the season because it's so fresh and tangy. And, you know, that there are, I'm sure that Leslie can give a better technical explanation of what that flavor profile is. But I, for us, it is, it's very fresh and very grassy and very, very, you know, unlike everything what people have been eating all winter.
It's not
long.
Heavy, right? And so, Leslie, I wonder, how would you describe, so I guess when we're thinking about, you guys produce, how many different types of cheese do you all produce at Prairie Fruits?
We produce about 7 or 8 types of cheese.
And so the Chav, like the kind of your main, what everyone would think of as their traditional goat cheese, is just the kind of the crumbly, soft. How does that taste different in the spring, like the first cheeses versus maybe in the summer?
I like to describe it as very light and fluffy and lemony. So the texture is very soft and supple in your mouth. And there's just a lot of bright notes to the flavor of that cheese.
And then how does that change later on in the summer or in the fall?
So when our goats are eating more pasture, fresh forage than anything else, the change goes more from the bright lemon notes to more vegetal or herbal kind of notes. And so our kind of summer mid-lactation milk produces a cheese that is also light in texture, but it's more herbal in quality.
Greg, do we see this with other cheeses apart from goat cheese? And I'm thinking of other American cheese production. Do we see this? I know when you and I were talking yesterday about how you can taste the difference with this with maybe some Wisconsin cheeses, like Alpine cheeses.
Yeah, in fact, so one of our mutual friends who makes cheese up in Wisconsin, award-winning Uplands cheese, making Pleasant Ridge Reserve, which is a, you know, pasture, you know, fed, and they don't even make cheese when they're not, when they don't have, you know, if the pasture gets burnt out, they'll sell the milk. But you can tell the color of the cheese changes during the course of the season when they have their most rich greens and clovers and things like that. You know, the chlorophyll and the carotene, the color of the deep yellow is there, but it's also reflected a little bit in the richness of the flavor. And when you have you know, when you're kind of off season or when you're kind of early in the season, it's a little bit paler and it's a little bit the flavor is, I wouldn't say it's dulled, but it is not as rich. So in some ways, I would say, and you know, scientists might prove me wrong, but from what I'm tasting and what I'm serving, something like a Pleasant Ridge Reserve comes into its own in the richness of June and early July when you have, you know, all the really developed pasture grazing materials. And then, but, you know, when we serve the stuff that comes right out of the first production from Leslie and Wes, it's, you know, it's, as she said, it's lemony, it's fluffy, it's got all those things. And I think a lot of the sheep's milk cheeses that we bring in from, you know, from around the surrounding states,
it has a similar taste, it sounds like, Greg, like in terms of the spring.
Well, I would say that the, you know, the soft ripened sheep milk cheeses somewhat mimic the goat's milk cheese as well. But I think goat's milk cheese, in my personal opinion, is the purest expression of fresh cheese seasonally, just right out of the box. It is so white, the color of white, that it's just so beautiful and I think it's the whitest of all of the milks.
We're almost out of time, but Leslie, I wonder if I can just ask you quickly, for people who are listening, this might be a big contrast from running into a big grocery store and just grabbing any cheese, any kind of year. What do you want people to know about seasons and where food comes from?
Well, I'd like them to know that there can be drastic changes in the flavor and the chemistry of the milk. But it also depends on scale, too. So in our case, you know, we're small scale. Our business is inherently seasonal, and we're pasture-based. And those things have a huge influence on the quality of the milk and how it changes across the seasons. And that isn't always the case with larger scale producers.
That's Leslie Cooper Band, one of the founders and co-owners of Prairie Fruits Farm in Urbana. I want to thank her, along with Greg O'Neill, co-founder of and owner of Pastoral Artisan Cheese, Bread, and Wine in Chicago. Both of you, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Hey, Greg.
Thank you so much.
That does it for us today. You can always head to 21stshow.org for more information about us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about how Methodists around the world and here in Illinois are struggling with a recent decision to uphold the church's stance banning same-sex marriage and LGBT orientation. We're a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. We'll see you tomorrow.